Political philosophy.
Yeah, section 3, the political philosophy of Plato. April 5th, 1965.
No. The primary subject of the Gorgias is rhetoric. But this subject recedes somehow. It is overlaid by the question of how man should live. Particular whether suffering injustice is better or worse than doing injustice. One may therefore say, in order to find a unity in the dialogue, the subject is not simply rhetoric, but just rhetoric, just speeches. There is another Platonic dialogue dealing with rhetoric, the Phaedrus. The subject of the Phaedrus is very clearly erotic speeches, both rhetoric and eros, erotic speeches. So the comparison of the two dialogues leads us to see the fundamental difference, of which we are aware, I suppose, anyway, but we see it as a great central Platonic theme, justice on the one hand, eros on the other. Which does not mean that these two things are mutually exclusive, but they are different. Their relation, however, is obscure. Now, Plato has taken up this difference on the grandest scale by writing the Republic on the one hand and the Banquet on the other. The Republic devoted to justice and the Banquet devoted to eros. Plato has then devoted two works, two dialogues, to rhetoric. Aristotle wrote, at least to speak only of what is surely genuine and preserved, a single treatise on rhetoric. Aristotle treats rhetoric entirely by itself, in isolation. There is no question of erotic speeches in Aristotle compared whether it deals with various kind of political speeches. Aristotle treats rhetoric in isolation. Plato, we may say, never treats the subject in isolation. And this explains the difference. To this one could make this objection, but the different dialogues have different subjects, say just speeches, erotic speeches. So he does treat subjects in isolation. Let me therefore make my statement somewhat more precise. Plato never treats a subject in isolation from the question of how one should live. When Aristotle deals with the parts of animals, he is only concerned with the parts of animals. And the question of how one should live is not immediately present. And the sign of the fact that this is a true situation, that Plato never treats the subject in isolation from the question of how one should live, the sign of that is the presence of Socrates in all dialogues. Socrates, whatever he may talk about, presents this question. If I say Socrates is present in all dialogues, I seem to have said the thing that is not. What's the objection?
Lost.
Yes, I admit that. But I would also say that I believe a deeper study of the laws would show that Socrates is present in the laws, under one assumption, that he did not follow the order of the laws to undergo capital punishment, but escape from prison, and then he would have gone to Crete and do his good work there. But this would need, of course, a long proof. Now let us complete our account of the Gorgias. Rhetoric is condemned as unjust on the basis of the view that the only thing which counts, the one thing needful, is justice. disregarding completely the bodily and external goods, abstracting from them and as well as from pleasure. So fundamental distinction of the good and the pleasant in such a way that every concern with pleasure seems to be wrong. Why? I mean, what is the basis of this possibility? Answer: if life is death, if the only true life is the life after death, and happiness after death is reserved for the just. And this is more or less the meaning of the myth, a so-called myth at the end. But justice does not mean quite the same in the gorgeous as it would mean to all men of all times and ages. Justice is somehow identified with philosophy, which is surely not the generally accepted view at any time. And of philosophy, Socrates says on his day of death, in the dialogue called Phaedo, philosophizing means learning to die. Now, this whole strand implies the otherworldliness, implies the depreciation of the city, because the city is, of course, essentially and radically this worldliness. But there is also an other strand in Plato's thought, and we will come across it by taking a key passage in Plato's Laws. Mr. Rankin will be so good and to do his pleasant duty. In the first book of the Laws, 631b7. Should I find it for you?
No, I think I can read it. For they are true laws.
No, at the beginning of the speech of the Athenian.
O stranger, thus you ought to have said, it is not for nothing that the laws of the Cretans are held in superlatively high repute among all the Hellenes. For they are true laws, as they affect the well-being of those who use them by supplying all things that are good. Now goods are of two kinds.
Yeah, they supply all good things. All good things. Yes.
Human and divine. And the human goods are dependent on the divine. And he who receives the greater acquires also the less, or else he is bereft of both. The lesser goods are those of which health, ranks.
Did you say he who acquires the greater? The city which acquires the greater. Yeah?
Oh. Yeah, the city which requires the greater requires also the less, or else is bereft of both. The lesser goods are those of which health ranks first, beauty second. The third is strength in running and all other bodily exercises. And the fourth is wealth. No blind god Plutus, but keen of sight, provided that he has wisdom for companion. And wisdom, in turn, has first place among the goods that are divine. And rational temperance, moderation of soul, comes second. From these two, when united with courage, there issues justice as the third, and the fourth is courage. Now all these are by nature ranked before the human goods, and verily the lawgiver also must so rank them.
That's all we need. The point, you see, you have here an order of four human goods and four divine goods. The human goods are the bodily and external goods, and the divine ones are the goods of the soul. And here Socrates, or the Athenian stranger rather says, the goods of the soul are the necessary and sufficient condition of the other goods in this life, because in another life there wouldn't be body and will. In the center of the Republic, Socrates says, the rule of the philosopher kings will make cease evils from the city. and the human race all together. And as he said shortly afterwards, the philosophers live already in this life, the life of the islands of the blessed. In other words, this passage in the Laws and the Republic, and of course many, many other utterances, show that Plato has a very high regard for the polis, which for the polis as this worldly thing. These two strands must be considered equally, and there is always a danger that one forgets one for the other. The otherworldly or this worldly, to say very simply. In the Middle Ages, Christian Middle Ages, the otherworldly Plato was much better known than the political Plato. In our age, of course, the opposite is true. And we must keep both in mind. Now, this tension or contradiction occurs also within the Gorgon. On the one hand, rhetoric is rejected as downright injustice. And on the other hand, we observe a certain rehabilitation of rhetoric. Rhetoric is rejected as a flattery, a kind of flattery. And on the other hand, it is admitted that rhetoric can be a genuine art, but does not yet exist. And it is the art of making the citizen just by means of speeches. But what about, so that this is quite political, but what about rhetoric which is used for one's just defense against unjust accusation? Is this also flattery, or can this be an art? Is a concern with such defense not just and reasonable? Callicles tells Socrates that Socrates will be the victim of every scoundrel if Socrates doesn't take care of his defense by rhetoric, which saves his life. Let us turn to, in the Gorgias, to 511b7.
Sorry, have a moment of patience.
Gorgias, 511b7. This is,
yes,
after this question has come up, Callicles says, now is this state of affairs that you are helpless over against every scoundrel, is this not a matter, a proper matter for indignation? Yeah, what was Callicles' address?
Yes.
What was
Socrates, not to a man of sense, as can easily be proved. Do you think that a man ought to make it his chief ambition to prolong his life to the utmost limit, and spend it in the practice of the arts which preserve us from danger? Oratory, for example, which you advise me to cultivate as a protection in the law courts. And very sound advice it is, too.
He swears by Zeus, by the way.
By Zeus.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, my good sir, do you also regard ability to swim as an important...
No, ability is too weak, the knowledge of swimming.
Yeah. Knowledge of swimming as an important accomplishment.
Yeah, as something grand.
Good heavens, no.
Yeah, he swears again, you see. He is very present. It's no longer a conversation for the benefit of Gorgias, but his own vital problem is involved. Yes?
Yet swimming saves men from death when they get into a situation that requires it. But if swimming seems to you a triviality, take a more important branch of knowledge, navigation, which, like oratory, saves not only people's lives, but also the persons and property which belong to them. Navigation is a modest
matter. Obviously, you cannot, by swimming, save large chests of gold. Yeah. Good. Yes.
Navigation is a modest art that knows her place. She does not put on airs or make out that she has performed some brilliant feat, even though she achieves as much as forensic oratory. She brings a man safe from Aegina for no more than 2 obols, I believe. And even if he comes from Egypt or Pontus or ever so far away, the utmost she charges for this great service for conveying in safety, as I said, a man and his children and property and womenfolk is 2 drachmae when he disembarks at the Piraeus. And the man who possesses this skill and has accomplished all this lands and walks about on the shore beside his ship in a quite unassuming way.
Yeah, now this is developed very amusingly and forcefully in the sequel. We cannot read that. We limit ourselves to this. The key point is this. Granted that forensic rhetoric can save a man's life, and he may not be wished to live until 80. Let's say a man of 20 or 30 could be unjustly accused, and one could not blame him for being unreasonably concerned with his life. Forensic rhetoric is as lowly an art as swimming, piloting, and as he makes clear in the sequel, generalship, which saves the cities, or medicine. And that is a crucial step. Forensic rhetoric is an art. Swimming is an art. And the other things are arts. Although nothing grand. Callicles unreasonably regards some of the life-saving arts as high and others as low. Rhetoric is high and swimming and piloting is low. He would never give his daughter in marriage to a pirate, but of course to a general he would, but that's very unreasonable. As Socrates makes clear, Callicles is under the spell of that convention which he claims to despise. He contradicts himself. He is concerned with life-saving above everything else, and at the same time he is concerned with being a courageous man. Now courage means exactly the virtue which controls and limits our desire to live. The willingness to die for something. And this is one of the many contradictions which he has. But if forensic rhetoric, as is now clearly admitted, forensic rhetoric, not the high rhetoric which Socrates claims to have, why does Socrates not practice it? For this we must turn to 521d6.
I believe that I am one of the few Athenians, perhaps there is no other, who studies the genuine art of statesmanship, and that I am the only man now living who puts it into practice. So because what I say on any occasion...
Yes, the true political art. Pericles and the Themistocles, they had a sham political art. And all the others. Except so as he's a true statesman. Yes?
So, because what I say on any occasion is not designed to please, and because I aim not at what is most agreeable, but at what is best, and will not employ the subtle arts which I advise, I shall have no defense to offer in a court of law. I can only repeat what I was saying to Polus. I shall be like a doctor brought before a tribunal of children at the suit of a confectioner. Imagine what sort of defense a man like that could make before such a court if he were accused in the following terms. Children, the accused has committed a number of crimes against you. He is the ruin of even the youngest among you with his surgery and cautery. He reduces you to a state of helpless misery by choking you with bitter draughts and inflicting upon you a regime of starvation which cuts you off from food and drink. What a contrast to the abundant and varied luxury with which I have entertained you. What do you think that the doctor could find to say in such a plight? If he were to utter the truth and tell the children that he had done all these things in the interest of their health, think of the prodigious outcry that a court so constituted would raise.
You see, he cannot say the truth. If he were to say the truth, there would only be an outcry. Yes?
Perhaps it would. One would have to be prepared for it. Then, don't you think that the accused would be at his wit's end for a reply? No doubt he would. Well, that is the situation in which I am sure that I shall find myself if I come before a court of law. I shall not be able to point to any pleasures that I have provided for my judges. The only kind of service and good turn that they recognize. Indeed, I see nothing to envy either in those who purvey or those who receive such services. And if it is alleged against me, either that I am the ruin of the younger people...
That I corrupt the younger ones, to keep more literally to the ordinary translation of the former charge, yes?
Corrupt the young people by reducing them to a state of helpless doubt, or that I insult their elders by bitter criticism in public or in private, no defense will avail me.
Literally, I would not be able to say the truth. Yeah? Namely?
Say the truth. The truth being simply that in all that I say, I am guided by what is right, and that our indigents are in the interest of those who are sitting in judgment on me. So presumably, I shall have no alternative but to submit to my fate, whatever it may be.
So, stop here. Suarez explains here why he does not use the art of forensic rhetoric. Precisely because he has practiced the true political art, which is the true rhetorical art, he cannot save himself through forensic rhetoric, however justly used. The people will not understand him, and therefore it is useless for him to say the truth to them. This implies, of course, that his true rhetoric will have been almost completely or completely ineffective, because if he had had any influence on the citizen body, there would be perhaps a majority who would acquit him of the accusation. And this incidentally is important because he accuses Pericles and Themistocles and the others that they have made the people worse, the Athenian people worse than they were, because after they have given them all the benefits they gave, walls, navy, empire, they were accused by the people whom they benefited. Now Socrates too tried to benefit the Athenian people and had the same fate as Pericles, Themistocles and so on. This is of course not stressed, but must be noted. Socrates denies, or at least does not grant, that rhetoric is to be used for self-defense. He does grant that rhetoric is to be used for self-accusation, or for the accusation of one's friends, one's nearest and dearest, and one's city. I draw this inference. The self-defense of Socrates, of the philosopher, is possible only as accusation of the city. This he may do. For by defending himself, the philosopher would recognize the polis as judge on philosophy. He would recognize the polis as a tribunal which rightfully calls philosophy before itself. He would recognize the polis as an authority to which philosophy is subject. But this is clearly, as the Greeks would say, against nature. That the philosophy would have to be responsible to the polis. The only just thing is to question the authority of the city, to call the city before the tribunal of philosophy, to accuse the city, which does not recognize philosophy, i.e. to use accusatory rhetoric. Accusatory rhetoric is of course also a form of forensic rhetoric. But can the polis understand the claim of philosophy? The implication is no. But with the qualifications, the city might understand it. Namely, if the peak or core of philosophy is disregarded, then the citizen body might get some inkling of what philosophy is. Now, in the Apology and Crito, of which you doubtless have heard, and many of you will have read them, in the Apology and Crito, Socrates does recognize the authority of the city and of its laws. In the Apology, because he defends himself against the formal charge in a formal law court. And in the Crito he says, no, I must not stealthily run away from prison because the laws are sacred and must be obeyed. In the Gorgias he questions the authority of the city without however making fully clear the character of philosophy. Needless to say, he made the character of philosophy much less clear even in the Apology and the Crito. In the Republic, however, he makes the character of philosophy fully clear. And the answer is there. Here he gives a solution to the conflict between city and philosophy. The philosophers must rule, i.e. the city as such must be absolutely subject to philosophers. The alternative being that the philosophers are subject to the non-philosophers, which is against nature, to use this phrase. From the Gorgias, the conflict between philosophy and the city appears to be insoluble. The solution suggested in the Republic, and that the philosophers are kings, is not considered in the Gorgias, perhaps alluded to, but not more. Now, one can of course say, how do you know that the conflict is insoluble? Is this not a very, as I say, pessimistic view of the situation, a prejudice as much as the opposite, optimistic view? The insolubility of the conflict between philosophy and the city is demonstrated ad oculos, to our eyes, by the only Athenian citizen with whom Socrates converses in the Gorgias, that is Callicles. Here you have a man who is not particularly biased against Socrates or against philosophy, but yet you see how he reacts. Socrates has no influence on Callicles, but Gorgias has. The question thus arises, could Gorgias not tame the Callicleses of various levels, the city, so that the city would let Socrates live and even listen to him? Hence, there must be, there ought to be another kind of rhetoric, as distinguished from vulgar rhetoric, as ordinary practice, from just forensic rhetoric, and the true rhetoric, which Socrates claims is necessary, you know, there must be another kind of rhetoric which tames the demos, the citizen body as a whole, by ingratiating itself with it, by appealing to it. This teaching of the good, which has nothing to do with the pleasant, would have this effect of the physician giving bitter pills, simply repulsive. And we have seen that Gorgias spoke when he went with his brother to a patient, and the brother could not possibly convince the patient to undergo an unpleasant operation or whatnot, the rhetorician, Gorgias, could do it without knowing anything of medicine. The dialogue Gorgias, we can say, is an appeal to Gorgias to do that, to, as it were, to mollify the demons, like Orpheus mollified the beasts, so that they will let men like Socrates alone and do their work. This interpretation is indirectly confirmed by the situation in the Republic. I have said already before that the Republic consists of three parts. It consists of three parts in many ways, but I mean in one particular way. There is a father-son conversation with Cephalos and Polemarchos in the first book, then the Thrasymachos section, and then finally the brothers and brothers section, Glaucon and Adamantus, book 2 to 10, bulk of the work. Now the Gorgias is built up in strictly parallel way. First dialogue with Gorgias, then with Polos, and then with Callicles. And so Thrasymachos is here in the center, occupying the same central position which Polos occupies apparently in the Gorgias. Now, and this Thrasymachos has a certain similarity with Polos, because he is also rather savage. And Polos is a Greek word for colt, untamed, not broken in. And Thrasymachos is obviously very savage, as you see from the very beginning. In spite of that, Socrates says somewhere in the 5th or 6th book that he and Thrasymachos have become friends while they never were enemies. The context in which he makes the remark is when he shows how one could tame the demons, persuade the demons of the birth of philosophy. So here Thrasymachos fulfills a function there in the Republic which Gorgias is meant to fulfill in the city at large. Needless to say that Thrasymachos is here in a very select company of few people where it is very easy to win compared with the marketplace. To come back to the point I made, so rhetoric is absolutely needed in order to bring about a reconciliation, some reconciliation between philosophy and the city. But this reconciliation requires that philosophy undergoes some obfuscation. Philosophy as such cannot be reconciled. The condemnation of rhetoric in the Gorgias is linked up with a scheme according to which the legislative art is the highest art. I will remind you. Instruments. I think it is one of the great virtues of state universities, in my experience, that you never have troubles with chalk. They are very generous, the state legislatures, much more than our maintenance service here. I don't say that this is the only conservation to apply to universities, but it is not altogether negligible. It may be a low thing, but an important. Now you remember the key. What was it? Body, soul, gymnastics, medicine, legislative art, and the art of judging. Good. And the art of judging, the latter in corresponding Greek is rhetoric. And this is soft. This is kind of what we need now. It's Now I said the condemnation of rhetoric, the unqualified condemnation, is linked up with the scheme according to which the legislative art is the highest art. The art taking care of building up the health of the soul is distinguishing from restoring itself. We must therefore say philosophy appears to begin with in the guise of the legislative art. That the citizen can understand that laws are necessary, therefore legislation, and also that intelligent legislation having principles and having fundamental clarity is preferable to random legislation. So philosophy appears in the guise of the legislative art. But now, rhetoric has been rehabilitated to some extent in the Callicles section, as we have seen. How does this affect the status of the legislative art, as we have to consider now? And let us turn a read a few short passages. 503d5.
Well, is there anyone you can name, Socrates speaking?
Now let me see. Oh, I'm the wrong page. 503d5. Yes, yes.
Is there anyone that you can name among the politicians of the past, from the first public appearance, one can date a change for the better in the from whose first public appearance one can date a change for the better in the character of the Athenians?
That's not the passage I mean. Give it to me. I'm the right. Here.
D.
D. Yes.
I can speak.
Yeah.
Callicles, I do not know how to answer you. You will find an answer if you look carefully. Let us consider quite calmly whether any of the men you have named was of this type. Come now. The good man who always aims at the best in what he says.
Yeah, who always speaks with a view to the best. Yeah?
Yes. Will have some definite object in view, will he not? He will no more proceed at random than other professional men, each of whom chooses and employs means and materials with an eye to his particular task, in order that what he is fashioning may have a definite form. Take, for example, painters, architects, shipwrights, any other profession you like, and see how each of them arranges the different elements of his work in a certain order, and makes one part fit and harmonized with another, until the thing emerges a consistent and organized whole. Among other professions...
No, that is more precisely. Ordered and adorned. Yeah, ordered and adorned. That is considered is a bit literary. Until the whole comes together as an ordered and adorned thing. Yes?
Among other professional men are those who deal with the body, trainers and doctors, whom we have already mentioned. They may be presumed to give order and proportion to the body. Are you?
Yeah, that is all we need. You see, here he speaks of the form, the same word which is ordinarily translated by idea. This is the same word which Plato means with idea. Socrates does not say that the craftsman, and hence, of course, also the legislator, looks at the idea which he tries to bring, to impose on the matter, but he looks at the order. The idea, the form, the shape, is only in the finished product. He looks at the taxes, at the order, then he brings forth a form, say, of the shoe or table. There is no transcendent idea here. Which means the doctrine of ideas, the famous doctrine, does not come out in the gorgeous. And that would mean on the simple and superficial level, on which we have to argue first, that since for Plato philosophy is above all the doctrine of the ideas or forms, that philosophy does not come out. Now, a bit further on in 506d, like David.
Yes, sir. Go on, my good sir, and finish on your own. Listen then, while I recapitulate the argument from the start. Is pleasure identical with good? Callicles and I agree that it is not. Is pleasure to be sought as a means to good, or good as a means to pleasure? Good as a means to pleasure. Is pleasure something whose presence makes us pleased, and good something whose presence makes us good? Certainly. But we, and everything else that can be called good, are good by reason of the presence of some excellent quality, are we not?
Some goodness, yeah.
That seems... some goodness. That seems an inevitable conclusion, Callicles. Now, the excellence of anything...
Or the goodness, yeah.
The goodness of anything...
And the word arete, which we only translate by virtue, but which has indeed the meaning of goodness or excellence. Yes?
Whether it be an implement or a physical body, or a soul, or any living being, is not manifested at random in its highest form, but springs from a certain order...
It doesn't come to the thing in a random way. Yes?
But springs from a certain order and rightness and art appropriate in each case. Is that true? In my opinion, yes. Then the goodness of the thing depends on its having a certain ordered beauty, which is the result of arrangement, is what I should say. Consequently, the presence of the order proper to it is what makes each thing good. So I believe. It follows that the soul which possesses the appropriate kind of order is better than the disorderly, obviously. And the soul which possesses order is orderly, of course. And if orderly, disciplined by good sense.
Yeah, or moderate. Yeah.
Unquestionably. So the disciplined soul is good after all. I can't see any other conclusion, my dear Callicles. Can you tell
so,
me?
That's all right. So the excellence or virtue or goodness of any thing or being is due to order, praxis, and cosmos, ornament. A soul which has received this by the art of the true statesman is cosmia, as the adjective of cosmos, derived from cosmos, is adorned, and this is has in Greek a better family, and it practices the same meaning as moderate, is well ordered, is well ordered. Which means, as would become clear from the sequel, virtue is reduced to moderation in contradistinction of justice, to justice. Now we come to the key passage to which this turns, but I must remind you of the word cosmos, which is here hitherto used in a perfectly commonsensical meaning. And can mean the simply external adornment, say, of a woman. And can, of course, also mean the good order introduced, say, into a room or into a table or any other thing. Now let us turn to the key point, 507c, where the new paragraph begins.
That, then, is the position that I adopt and maintain to be true. If I am right, then it appears that each of us who wants to be happy must pursue and practice self-discipline.
Yeah, that is sophrosyne all the time, moderation. Yeah.
Moderation. And run as fast as his legs will carry him from licentiousness. He must make it his main endeavor not to need correction. But if either he or anyone in whom he is interested, be they individuals or a whole city, should stand in need of it, correction must be inflicted, and the penalty paid, if happiness is to be achieved. This seems to me the goal that one should have in view throughout one's life. We can win happiness only by bending all our own efforts and those of the state to the realization of uprightness and moderation, not by allowing our appetites to go unchecked, and in an attempt to satisfy their endless importunity, leading the life of a brigand. The man who adopts the latter course will win the love neither of God nor of his fellow men. He is incapable of social life, and without social life there can be no love.
Friendship would be the more literal translation, but love is not entirely incorrect, of course. Yeah?
We are told on good authority, Callicles, that heaven and earth and their respective inhabitants are held together by the bonds of society.
No, a bit more literal, that heaven and earth and gods and human beings, yeah?
Gods and human beings are held together by the bonds of society and love, philia, and order and discipline and righteousness. And that is why the universe is called an ordered whole.
No, that's not good. And this is the reason why this whole is called cosmos. Yeah?
Called cosmos. And not a state of disorder and license. You, I think, for all your cleverness, have failed to grasp the truth. You have not observed how great a part geometric equality plays in heaven and earth.
Among gods and men. Yeah.
Among gods and men. And because you neglect the study of geometry, you preach the doctrine of unfair shares.
Yeah, of, in other words, of getting as much as you can. So, this is the last passage of Rogers which we absolutely need. So here, a study of the cosmos. Cosmos was a relatively recent term at that time. It means literally ornament. Something adorned, beautiful. But this is here linked up with the notion of geometric equality, of proportional equality. With a slight acceleration, we can say, mathematical cosmology is the basis of the true rhetoric of politics. This is the genuine thing, of which sophistry is a perversion. Not the legislative art. The legislative art is much lower in rank, because as we have seen last time, psychology is necessarily the basis of the legislative art, but psychology as a psychology of man can only be a part of a larger whole, namely the cosmos. This is the utmost extent to which the character of philosophy is revealed in the Gorgias, in this passage. By the way, does this remind you of something else you know of Plato, this mathematical cosmology? Yes?
Well, his academy there was assigned about no geometry coming to my school or something?
Yeah, like? But this is not, yes, this is true, but there is a work, yes.
So is it in the Republic where has the figure of the line and
divides
it into the...
That is not something very obvious. One of the more, in the Middle Ages, the most famous Platonic work was the Timaeus. And the Timaeus develops this mathematical cosmology. And it is no accident, I believe, that the term law of nature occurs only in the Gorgias, when it is used by Callicles, and in the Timaeus, where it is used by Timaeus. This only in passing. The study of this cosmos, of this whole, is another whole, leads to cosmiotes, to the quality of being cosmios, i.e. orderly, which is the same as moderate or self-controlled, and which is here presented as the root virtue. But the question of course arises, is mathematical cosmology the highest? Are not the ideas higher? And in this connection, I remind you again of the fact that the Gorgias, which has to say so much about justice, never raises the question of what justice is, so that we are in a way always in the dark what they are talking about. But in a very general way, we know it, in a commonsensical way, but that is surely not sufficient. We may say, draw this conclusion, that the rehabilitation of rhetoric goes together with the revelation of philosophy as mathematical cosmology. We must say at least a word about the dramatic situation. The important change from the simple condemnation of rhetoric to its rehabilitation is somehow rendered possible by Callicles. By Callicles' appeal to nature in contradistinction to convention. Callicles realizes the necessity of appealing from what is by convention just or noble to what is by nature just or noble. This appeal is the work of philosophy. But he also says that after one has discovered what is by nature right and noble in one's youth, one must turn to grander things. And now you know it. What should you further bother about it? Now you lead the just life, meaning the life of self-aggrandizement in this case. Philosophy is not the right kind of life. And this is clearly the opposite of Socrates. Whose view one can state as follows, the natural right, that which is by nature right, is a life devoted to philosophy. Hence the discovery of natural right keeps one with philosophy. Isn't that clear? Whereas if the natural right is not philosophy, then one turns away from philosophy to the practice of this natural right, and that whatever that may be. Now, Callicles' primary motive has appeared from a passage to which we have read in 511d, may be said to be this, a very noble one, or a respectable one. The philosopher is, like Socrates, is helpless against his persecutors. He is animated by moral indignation that such a man like Socrates should be at the mercy of every scoundrel. Philosophers must enable themselves to defend themselves against their enemies. This is not reasonable. But then a strange thing takes place. The action taken on behalf of philosophy in order to defend it should remain subordinate to philosophy. But in Callicles' case, it becomes more important than philosophy itself. And that is the fundamental contradiction. One would have to study this carefully, which we cannot do here, namely that there is a way which leads from the perfectly sound and just self-defense of the better man, especially, to the right of the stronger. And this is explained at some length in the Gorgias. What can he do in order to defend himself? The better man must, as in order to protect himself, must assimilate himself to the powerful, to the strong. And then that is, of course, the beginning of the end. Because he will then, such assimilation corrupts him naturally. He must be useful to the strong, otherwise they would not take any interest in him. And how can he be useful to the strong unless he adopts their ends, which are not his ends? He must, to use a present-day phrase, he must become an ideologist of the regime. But this is very good and necessary, I suppose, but it is of course not philosophy. So this is all I wanted to say about the gorgeous. And before I go on, I must make a longish speech, but in order not to make a mistake, I must look at the time.
It's comical. And the public is safe. I mean, that needs modification, but to begin with, that is so. Everything which is private is comical. And, now, and then in the next stage, we must make quite some jumps. In 553C or so, the oligarchic man, as distinguished from the democratic man, gives the reign to the desire. You remember the... Here we have reason in control. Here we have spirit in control. Here we have desire in control. Here there is something fishy, isn't it? We have three parts of the soul and five regimes. Is that funny? What shall we do with democratic and democratic men? How does he solve this question?
He splits desire into three parts.
Yeah, and the first division is which?
Necessary and not necessary.
So, necessary desire and non-necessary desire. Good, and he will have to make another subdivision to account for the time. So that's the way. You know that in these three regimes have the same psychological principle, preponderance of desire. Yeah? These three.
Yes.
Yeah. That can have great implications into which we cannot now go. But then it is made clear, let us turn to 556C, 8. That is, I believe, the first occurrence of this problem, 556C, 8. Mr. Reinken? I mean, this is the situation in an oligarchy. You know, the men of wealth, the men who hitherto they seem to be very low fellows compared to the squires, even to the squires, but still more, of course, to the philosophers. As these are the money-grabbing fellows, you know, the money bags. And now that effect that you described. And read this passage.
And when, thus conditioned, the rulers and the rules are brought together on the march, wayfaring, or in some other common undertaking, either a religious festival or a campaign for his shipmates or fellow soldiers, or for that matter, an actual battle, and observe one another, then the poor are not in the least scorned by the rich, but on the contrary, do you not suppose it often happens that when a lean, sinewy, sunburnt pauper is stationed in battle beside a rich man bred in the shade and burdened with superfluous flesh and sees his hand and helpless, do you not suppose he will think that such fellows keep their wealth by the cowardice of the poor, and that when the latter are together in private, one will pass the word to another, "I'm
never
good for nothing"?
You know, well, one could, a better translation would be, our hombres. You see, because man doesn't have the force of the Greek word used here. You know so much Spanish, I suppose, as I do. Our hombres, well, they are nothing. Yeah? Because a man, in an emphatic sense, is of course a wealthy man. I mean, that is as true today as it was at all times. Pardon?
19th century English.
Or even today, when you speak of an hombre, in any emphatic sense, he is a property of man. Just, you know, as a father par excellence is a property father, otherwise he has not that power over his children, which a father should have. This Locke has analyzed this very beautifully. You remember that in the chapter of property, I think it is? How does he put it? That a father, after the children are grown up, does not have any more a natural tie on their obedience, but he has a tie via the property. And Locke, this master of understatement, says, this is not a small tie. Yeah? the hombre is of course a wealthy man. He should not have translated, used the word pauper here. Penes in Greek is not pauper. That would be a different Greek word. The poor are of course as such respectable people, are not beggars. Now you see here, that's very interesting. Here we have the confrontation of the rich and the poor, and in this context the poor appear to be much nicer people, you know. Yes?
I'm sorry.
That we must consider. The poor, I mean, you remember this beautiful description of the craftsman, you know, in the third book, you know, who doesn't, is not a valetudinarian. He simply goes to the physician and says, well, can I work again after a short treatment? And if the physician said no, you will be laid up for the rest of his life, and then no. Rather dead than, you know, whereas the wealthy man would live on pills and on other things of this kind. So the poor men, in this sense, they are respectable fellows in their way. And here, now, but under development, later developments, in which regime are the poor in control? In democracy. And that is one of the biggest hopes and practices of the public, you know, that the democratic man, as presented there, is not the poor. These are the deserters from their class, you know. How do you call this kind of people? I mean,
de classe
nobility, you can say. Or, the playboys, you know, a certain kind of playboys who play in politics, you know, and see they have no chance, black sheep of the family, who haven't got a chance in the old regime and never become demagogues. That's the democratic manager of the republic. Whereas here we have, there are later indications of this effect, but they are played down. The true democratic man almost disappears in the republic. So there is a deliberately distorted picture. We will have to come back to this later. There was, this was this passage, yeah. I think one can say that there is a certain difficulty here, which one can, I formally said there is a double genesis of democracy. But the difficulty is rather this, I think. There is an account of the genesis of democratic man which precedes the account of the genesis of democracy. And then there follows the official account of the genesis of democratic man. And this is done for the purpose in order to conceal the true democratic man. The democratic man must be the son of an oligarchic father.